Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
How's it going, everybody? This is Andy McCullough from The Athletic here with Mark Carrig, also from The Athletic. You are listening to a special virtual winter. What is it? The winter weedings? The winter meetings? That's what they're called?
I believe that's correct.
You are listening to the special virtual winter meetings edition of Beyond the Scrum. That's Mark Carrig. I'm Andy. How are you guys doing? I guess I was just talking to the audience. It's been a while since we podcasted, Mark. I forget how to do this medium.
Yeah, no, it's been a while. It's good to see you again, though.
It's great to see you as well.
Yes, I like your shirt. Very festive.
Yeah, it's a flannel. I decided to wear something different today.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we have a great guest here as we're going to be getting into the off season. What's happened already? What is to come? What we're missing about not having an actual winter meetings this year? It's Mike Ferrin from SiriusXM and Arizona Diamondbacks Propaganda. Mike, how are you?
Great, Andy. It's... nice to be with you.
How are things over at Pravda?
Yeah, D-backs Pravda.
Yeah.
I actually want to talk about the D-backs. I am interested.
Would you
in the
like
D-backs.
To?
That's I actually know. I have
America's
some,
team.
America's team. Yeah. Yeah. I like the D-backs. Hey, please rate.
No, it's
US
a fact,
iTunes.
Jack. You do like the D-backs.
Oh, I do love that song. That is no, my favorite. That is my favorite post-game victory song. Michael, how are you, man?
I'm great. It's nice to see your guys' faces. I wish we were standing around making fun of passing together in a hotel lobby, but here we are.
Passan, who, you know, just debases himself on the worldwide leader, you know, weekly at this point, said this podcast is lame. So if you disagree with him, please rate and review us on iTunes.
I have to say, I've listened to it a couple of times, and I must say it is the most mundane podcast I have ever listened to.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
It's just mundane. It is what it is. No, wow. You guys have done some great stuff. The Ross Stripling interview this, what month was that again?
It was like March
78th,
okay.
Right? That was really good.
Yeah, that was with me and Pedro. Thanks for listening, Michael.
Thanks,
Oh, sorry.
That was that was the Dodgers podcast. It's all right.
Well, that was good.
Yeah, close That's enough. Good.
You That's still true. Doing that one, Andy?
We're doing lots of things here at The Athletic. You can subscribe at theathletic.com. There's no winter meetings. How are you guys holding up without it?
Well, I mean, I can only speak for me, but I actually love the winter meetings because I get to stand around and drink with you guys for 4 days. You know, like we see each other a little bit maybe during the course of the season, but we don't get everybody together except at Jewel events. And at the winter meetings, there's a lot more downtime than there is if you're covering an all-star game or you know, the World Series or a league championship series. So I miss it. I mean, the thing I miss the most about regular baseball this year was just seeing everybody, you know, having random conversations with either friends who are journalists or scouts or, you know, talking to coaches or players, any of that. I like baseball I love the sport, but I like covering baseball because people in baseball tend to like to talk about baseball. And there's a lot of time to stand around and have conversations over the course of the day. And as an extrovert, I missed that. So my dogs are really tired of me discussing, you know, whether or not it's actually $5 million a win versus $8 million a win on the free agent market. And, you know, whether or not the you know, Rapsodos do a good enough job of tracking spin axes and, you know, how to pair that stuff together. And I would rather have somebody else that doesn't just bark at me have that conversation. I would rather them bark at me in English as opposed to in dog.
Sure. Yeah. My cat is very confused why I keep asking why the Rockies DFA'd or non-tender David Dahl, but are paying Michael Givens. It just, you know, but my cat is just like, please leave me alone. I don't care about this.
You know what the line is for this? I finally figured it out the other day. Is anytime you come up with anything that can't be explained in 2020, you just have to pause and go, the aristocrats.
There you go.
That's it. Mm. That's what it is. It's the aristocrats. That's why the Rockies are doing that.
Yeah, the Rockies. God bless them. Mark, how are you, man?
No one cares, Andy, but I'm fine. I'm fine.
I care.
No, you don't. Just stop. Stop with your bullshit already. We're not even 5 minutes into this thing, and you're already full of crap. You don't care.
Mark,
but I'm
care
fine.
More about you than I do, Andy.
Well, that's true. Nice. Maybe that's true. I'm well, Andy. I never thought I would say this, but I miss the winter meetings. It's my annual heater palooza. So that sort of sucks to not have that. And it is fun to see everybody meandering about, like going through that hallway and hearing Farron's voice bounce around like a basketball while you're trying to like hear Boris, you know, like you're like leaning in, trying to hear Boris. You got Farron barking in the background, not always in that hallway, always in front of like the media room.
Yep. Right in front of the media center.
Always there.
Always interviewing Ron Renicky or something.
Yes, it's always Farron and a former Met GM riding shotgun every year somewhere, you know. I do miss that. It is good to see you, Farron. My daughter, who is going to turn 3, I think it was last month, goes, "This is power, Allie. We listen to the show so much that when it's not on, she's like, 'Daddy, where's baseball?'" So, although you don't listen to this podcast, we listen to your show. You do a hell of a job. And apparently she thinks so too.
Well, tell her thank you. We are trying to appeal to a younger audience. That's why they have two middle-aged white guys hosting the program.
Yes. No, she's really more into Duquette than you, but that's
probably.
Okay.
Yeah. I figured she likes the Brady's Ladies and Gentlemen MLB Network Radio proudly presents, where he asks Jim to determine whether or not somebody played for the Phillies in the 1930s or it's a craft bourbon. It's one of my favorites.
What is the – I've been meaning to ask you this. Like, in you guys' intro – like there's all these like baseball like general terms, and then you got, I think it's you and Duquette going hot chocolate. What the hell is that from? Like, what is that a reference to?
You know what? I don't even make sense where it came from. It probably was. It's something that's happened relatively recently, like within the last 3 or 4 months, and I think it might be A-Rod related. Hang on, let me send a text message. And like, Rod is our favorite whipping boy, right? Because like, I actually made t-shirts that say bacon on the table.
Bacon on the table. Oh, beautiful.
I don't remember exactly where it came from, but we just act like assholes for the most part. So like, it doesn't really matter.
You guys have gotten a lot of mileage out of the bacon on the table thing, which is super, super entertaining.
I mean, the fact that he went back to it again, like 8 weeks later, after he said, like, the whole premise was that, what was it, guys like Rafael Devers and Xander Bogaerts are the guys you want up in the big spots when the bacon is
on the table.
And
he's then, obsessed like, with bit, right man, right spot. That's his tick.
He's obsessed with bunting.
That too.
The other one was from opening night. It was who was I can't remember who from the Nationals laid down the sacrifice, and he said, "Heads you win, tails you win more." There was a really pretty good made for TV movie probably about 15, almost 20 years ago about the early days of Monday Night Football called Monday Night Mayhem. And there are some clips in there of what OJ was like as a sideline guy, which are just like, you know, I got a tip from a source that the Chiefs are talking to Stram about a head job. Like, that's what I think of every time I hear Rod talk.
I don't know if that's the right comp. Mike, and we're just going to move on. We're just going to move on and
obviously,
say that the views of our guests do not reflect the views of Beyond the Scrum. That's all I'd like to say about that. Hey, I got a question for you, Michael. So it seems like James McCann's going to get 4 years. Mike Minor and Carlos Santana seem like they got fair-ish deals, you know, like deals that made sense. Drew Smyly got $11 million. It was – like I talked to a lot of execs and agents this summer who were kind of predicting doom and gloom this offseason. I'm sure, you know, you did as well. Like, was that misplaced? Like, is this offseason – behaving normally, at more normal than we would have expected?
I think so. I mean, I think the numbers that we've seen on players are pretty reasonable. They might be a little bit of haircuts and spot. Like we tried to have this debate because I'm sure you guys had similar conversations where there was a feeling that payrolls were going to roll back, what, 20 to 30%, right? That was what I tended to get the range was. And so if you add a 20% premium to most of the contracts you have now, they certainly would look like, you know, like take Charlie Morton, for example, right? 1 year, $15 million is what he gets, which was what the option was that the Rays declined. If you were to add 30 or 20% to that contract, you're at what, like 1 in 18, right? Like if Charlie Morton in a normally winner had gone 1 in 18, you'd have gone, yeah, that's, you know, it's a good number for him. That's basically what Cole Hamels got last year, right? So yeah, that makes sense. And I think you're right. I mean, it has been a little bit of a haircut in terms of what you would normally get on a market. I mean, league average players getting about $5 million a win, you know, in wins above replacement, it is, you know, what I think Eno Saris was just recently writing about. In fact, we were talking about that article this morning. And so if Santana and like Adam Eaton are just a tick below that, then yeah, I mean, I think that's about where it is. So maybe there's a 20% reduction for guys, but for the most part, nobody feels like they've signed a deal where you go, whoa, that's really crazy out of line. Now, James McCann, if he signs for 4 years, that's going to feel crazy out of line for a guy who was non-tendered 2 years ago, but we don't really at this time know what the money looks like in that. And I can't imagine that it's going to be so significant that, you know, that it's going to be, we're going to go, oh my gosh, this guy got a $60 million deal. I just don't see that happening.
I remember it might've been like a decade ago, but I remember like Randy Choate got a 3-year deal and I was like, I mean, are you serious? A 3-year deal? And it's like, oh, well, they're paying him like $1 million a year. So like, why, you know, like who cares? So like, yeah, if McCann gets, you know, 4 for 32, it's like, okay. If he gets, you know, as you said, 4 for 60, then it's, you know, we're in sort of bizarro land. But yeah, I mean, I think like, it was interesting, like, was the non-tender deadline a bloodbath? No. Was it pretty bad for labor? Yes. And it's kind of interesting trying to find, like, what the middle ground is on that, I guess.
But I think it's been bad for labor over the course of the last several years. I mean, I think that's what the trend has been. No. I would say that the trend line really when it comes to the tender deadline has been the last 4 or 5 where you've seen the numbers go up. And I think what's happened is that you've seen teams devaluing the major league regular. I mean, I think in Ken Rosenthal's article, he had a great quote from Barry Meister about basically the rank and file major leaguers are the ones who are really suffering in this. And those guys who are league average to slightly below, they're the ones that take a hit. And what ends up happening is that the market, because that's the vast majority of players, gets flooded then. So it helps to drive prices down. I mean, I think in the end, this acted a lot like most other, you know, tender deadlines. And so you end up with a flood of extra free agents. I mean, there were a few more, I think it was close to 60, right, this year. Mm-hmm. And last year it was like 53. Yeah. So you end up with a bunch of guys that are going to drive down the price on those league average regulars or slightly below league average. I think where the difference comes in this year was on what would seem to be modest cost options that were declined or reasonable cost options for decline. That to me is where the big difference was. So Morton would fit in that range. Carlos Santana to some degree would fit in that range. I realize he only hit like $1.99 last year, but like it was 60 games. So whatever, you know, and that guy's been pretty durable and high on base corner. Yeah.
He was
corner
awesome bat in 2019.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, I mean, checks all the intangible boxes and all that too. Mm-hmm. So like the you start to see that even Adam Eaton, I think was like 10.5 was what his option was. Once he gets 7.5 from the White Sox, like if he had had a relatively normal year in terms of length, there's a good chance that Washington ends up picking that up. So rather than the tender deadline, I think in retrospect, what it looks like is that those options, those reasonable options of guys like that and Colton Wong are what helped to create this extra glut on the market. But again, they're all guys that are in the same role. The really great players didn't have their contracts. You know, they had their options picked up, and they're also the ones that are going to get paid this month.
As always.
As always.
Right? I mean, as always. You know, it's there's going to be just enough. There's going to be just enough teams, it seems, where they're going to be kind of on that more aggressive end of the spectrum. The Mets, the Jays, you know, whomever, right? Like that's and that's going to help too, I think, is that you've got some teams that like historically you wouldn't put in that group, right? Like the Mets certainly are not historically in that upper right. tier group. So when I see them, you know, basically getting close with McCann, like what's the next thing, right? George Springer? Like that, right. that's sort of, and like, I think no one would be shocked by that. So, which is crazy to say, given that franchise. Toronto has been acting that way. Like they came out early and put some money in early. So, you know, I think that sort of is a element of this too, is that you've got some franchises that historically haven't been as involved and yeah, maybe they help in some sense pick up the slack because, you know, you got some other teams that are kind of going backwards in this period, which you can kind of see.
But I think you always are going to pay for premium talent. I mean, I think that's the thing that we've always learned in free agency is that the high end of the market is always going to get paid what the high end of the market is going to get paid. I mean, I don't think that there's been a year where that didn't happen, even in what was the misery of 2 years ago in the winter. Machado and Harper got their money in the end, right? Yeah. They both got over $300 million. They still got paid. So I don't think that that's, even if there were, everybody was saying, oh, we're going to cut costs, we're going to cut costs. Somebody's going to pay those players what they're worth. What's changed is the value that no longer does what is the line about like a rising tide, you know, lifting all mm-hmm. ships, right? That's not the case in free agency anymore. Yeah. And so what's happened is that, you know, okay, those guys are getting their money, but then it's not pulling everybody else up in the market because teams aren't as desperate because they have a better idea of, or are more committed to the idea that if a guy is a league average player, you know, you can replace him with a league average player regardless of the position, you know, or you can find that guy relatively cheaply now. I mean, in the last 5 years, that's changed significantly. I mean, think about this. Like 5 years ago, we were talking about what Jeff Samardzija, Mike Leake getting these like 75, 85 yeah. million dollar contracts, right? Like those guys, pitchers like that on the free agent market now, you know, like what, like let's use Jake Odorizzi as an example, right? Jake Odorizzi is a pretty good pitcher. I know he had a bad statistical mm-hmm. year in his four starts and had some weird injuries, but like, what's a reasonable number for him? Like 3-30? Like 3-30, you know, like half yeah. basically what Leake and or less than half than what Samardzija got for, yeah. you know, almost half that time. So we're not seeing those double markets anymore because of that. And I think this is where I want to soapbox about the union and some of the mistakes that they continue to make, like not raising up the league minimum to a point where players don't feel like, especially star players, don't feel like they have to take a nine-figure contract before they even reach arbitration to mm-hmm. avoid free agency has been is something that needs to be fixed, because when you need to get those stars to free agency, but you also need to be able to find a way to make it more reasonable to see, you know, solid players get paid commensurate on their talent level.
So who's like an example of that? Who is a guy who like isn't, you know, isn't getting paid commensurate to his level?
Ronald Acuña Jr.
Well, yeah, okay.
I mean,
but that feels like a specific case, though.
Well, no, I think, I mean, you think you can make the case on just about anyone, I mean, who signs,
I guess,
those.
Bregman's pretty similar.
Eloy Jimenez, I mean, has a very yeah. good chance to be that. Luis Robert might end up being that. I mean, basically, if you're taking advantage of those early on, I mean, Robert, yeah. at the very least, Robert's got a chance to be pretty special if he can
yeah.
tone down the strikeouts and have a little bit better approach. And, you know, listen, as he gets adjusted, I think he probably will. I mean, he does things that are pretty stupid, you know, but signing those early contracts have cost them money in free agency. And I yeah. think that there's, and even like the Ozzie Albies deal, like Ozzie Albies is a good player. He's not a great player, but he's a good player. And like taking that deal and taking him out of free agency probably hurts that, you know. Paul
yeah.
was the group of guys that got like the 6 and 7 year $23 million guarantee, the Paul DeYoungs, Ketel Marte, mm-hmm. You know, those kind of things. Maybe not the same with Kingery, Scott Kingery with the Phillies, because he just hasn't been very good so far. But like that kind of stuff, like you need to be able to to ensure that those contracts aren't happening, I think, if you're the union, so that you can get those guys to free agency to try and ensure that players are getting paid, you know, through that. And then there's right. the whole arbitration cases too, where you don't want to flood the market with free agents. So how do you handle that? Right. We're dealing with a lot of shit here.
Well, I guess the question is, like, if you are the union, and these two goals maybe aren't necessarily always misaligned, but is it to raise the average salary for everyone in the union, or is it for your individual members to get lifetime changing wealth? And sometimes those things are sort of competing, right? Like, that sort of financial security that some of those deals offer guys, it's understandable why they would take them. Now, I'm not like advocating for that and saying like all players should take, you know, pre-free agency deals, but like I've talked to lots of guys who, you know, say things like, well, I was, you know, was making the minimum, I had two kids, and they offered me $50 million, so I took it, and I never had to worry about money again for the rest of my life.
I think you have to make it tougher for them to make the decision. You know, if you if you have a minimum salary that's, let's say, what is it right now, Mark? It's what, 570, something like that? So you're talking about, like, if you even double that, you know, what it is, if you're talking about $1 million a year, and then the basic raises that come even in renewals, you know, I think it makes it a little bit easier to move on to at least think twice about signing that kind of contract. I mean, I don't think any player necessarily is beholden to everybody else that's in the players association to make deals for them. I think what you need to do is, like, if your job is to try and help get players generational wealth, that's going to be, you're going to be limited to the 1% of players or 2% of players. Like, you're not going to do that for everybody, you know, and it's really going to affect the guys that are the fringe ones who don't, you know, by the time they pay union fees and dues, taxes and all that stuff, you know, aren't actually making they're making good money, don't get me wrong, but they're not getting, like, we don't have to work anymore money. So I think that it's tough to try and do both, but I don't know that we can be in a position where it's a star driven system anymore.
You know, those deals also kind of in the bigger picture, right? Like, we were talking about free agency and the impact that'll have. Look, arbitration system, when you don't have guys pass through the system, they can't push the bar forward for everybody that comes after them. And while that isn't as stark or dramatic as the differences you'd see in free agency, over time, it affects more players and does have a significant impact on how guys are paid, especially the group that you were talking about earlier, right? Like those dudes who might get the arbitration, but odds are they're not going to get the free agency and like be in a position to like get a major league deal, right? So, because that's just the odds of it. You've got to play 6 years to get to free agency, and it's a very, very hard game. So the best chance for someone to get paid beyond the minimum then is to get to arbitration. But now the teams have like figured out that, you know, and they are working together, by the way, which is not illegal, right? It's not like collusion, because like they can work together. It's totally fine. But I think the fact that they've done that has altered the arbitration system and in effect, like, really impacted a really large swath of players. And it's not as perceptible as free agency. It's certainly not as dramatic. But for this class of players, it's a huge deal, I think.
I feel like what happened with Eddie Rosario is like really troubling, I guess, long term. That like a good player just like is getting cut because he was essentially too good but not good enough in a way. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like he's being punished for competence.
Well, I think you've seen that. There's at least one guy each of the last several years that you've seen that with. I'm trying to think back who it was last year, but there's always going to be guys like that. I mean, Rosario's not a very good defender. He doesn't get on base. Like, we can pick around the warts on him, certainly. You know, Schwarber's another example of that. Like, Schwarber probably would have been at a higher number even than $8 million if he hadn't, you know, had an injury in 2016 that cost him most of the year. But that's a 30-homer bat with high on base who isn't a very good outfielder, but is a slugger. And like that, those are the numbers that tend to get paid in arbitration. I think, Mark, to your point, one of the things that's important is not just raising that minimum, but trying to ensure that if teams are telling you that service time is the most important thing, right? Like let's look at the Lance Lynn trade, right? Dane Dunning's decent pitching prospect. I like him maybe a little bit more than some evaluators do, but most have him kind of pegged as a back end of the rotation guy.
But he's got 6 years still, right?
Yeah, he's got 6 years of control, right?
Yeah.
So, but if he's a back end starter and he really is like a number five starter and maybe just a shade below the league average, like the Rangers are going to non-tender him after year one of arbitration. And that's going to flood the free agent market again. And so what has to happen, I think, in those arbitration years are if a team is going to value 6 years of service time, then they should be committed to 6 years of service time, or there needs to be something that happens. This is all really complicated stuff that I don't fully understand because I'm an idiot. I mean, like, I'm a that makes broadcaster, three of us. But, yeah. But like, and it's not something I think that can necessarily be fixed in the next CBA without a significant kind of shutdown, which I really think is disastrous for the sport overall and the long-term health of both sides if they do shut down, especially after what happened this past summer. So, but there are some serious things that need to be adjusted in terms of the structure of the way contracts are handled. I mean, this arbitration structure is, you know, what, close to 50 years old, right? Like, it's, we have to modernize these collective bargaining agreements and the contract system to be able to fit the way the game is played now. And I personally do not think the union has done a particularly good job of advocating for those spots to try and move things forward, because the owners are going to take the system if it benefits them. They're going to keep
right,
hey man,
right.
Like, we don't have any issue to change. The players want to change it, they should change it. And I would hope that at some point they do decide to.
But what do the players have to offer back in exchange for making the big league minimum, you know, 1.5?
Expanded playoffs.
So, okay. So they can offer basically the destruction of the sport.
Well,
that's what they have to offer, essentially, is, you know, we're going to ruin the game.
I mean, it's going to happen regardless. I mean, there's too much money at stake, so it doesn't matter.
Where are you at on that? What do you got on the expanded playoffs?
So, like, you mean to the plan to have seven in each league? I don't love it.
I mean, in general.
I think the purist in me tends to come out more. I mean, I really, our friend Nick Picoro gave me a hard time about this summer when I told him that I really just didn't care as a fan about the postseason as much as I do the regular season, because I love the grind of the regular season. And he was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you're telling me if the Diamondbacks won the World Series, that wouldn't be quite as exciting? I'm like, well, no, obviously that would be exciting, but they're two completely different things that we're talking about. We're talking about 162 game, you know, I don't want to say necessarily battle of attrition, but like you're playing every day. You're going to work every day and competing for 6 months with 20 off days. And then you have this, all of a sudden, there's a magical schedule at the end where everybody resets. And, you know, with the exception of the last couple of years, the best team isn't necessarily going to win it. That's part of what makes the playoffs exciting, and playoff baseball is exciting for different reasons. But to me, they're completely separate than what the regular season and what the playoffs are. So I think you're right. It cheapens the regular season. I mean, I think one of baseball's great assets is the volume of games that it has. And I don't think we do a good enough job of treating it like that's one of their great assets. But I also think that, you know, like there's obviously going to be significantly more money made, because that's the chance to make money is in the postseason, and everybody wants more money because everybody wants to get paid more. And the more money, the more coverage, the more we're going to be able to be employed. Maybe we even, you know, get some cushy postseason assignments at some point, you know, that we wouldn't otherwise. And so that, I mean, I guess maybe that's trickle down economic theory, which I don't know that I necessarily buy into, but that's certainly the way that I would think that both the owners and players are looking at that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
What's kind of scary about all of this to me, anyway, is that we like to look for a precedent in history to kind of give us a sense of what will come forward. And so much of this feels unprecedented. And I mean that, like, look, they've had fights, right? Obviously, that's not unprecedented. But this is so much more of a sophisticated, complicated machine that they're trying to, like, deal with right now when compared to 30 years ago.
Yeah.
The stakes are so much higher than they were 30 years ago. There's more opportunity to try to make your case publicly now than there has ever been before. And you could argue, and we've seen this kind of in the general conversation, that those efforts are more sophisticated than they've ever been before too. And so it's like kind of like, you know, to me, when I look at it and I hear conversations like this, it kind of sends a chill up my spine, because it's really difficult to even know how this is going to go. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing to really compare it to. And I think sometimes comps are like, bring comfort in a weird way, because you can kind of know what to expect. And yeah, the general framework is there. We know it's a labor fight. But I just think there's so many aspects of this that we don't know, that the consequences are things we can't even really fathom right now.
Well, and I think you're talking about something that's contentious by nature, because it's a collectively bargained issue between labor and management. And then add into it the fact that one side may not feel like they're being treated fairly in terms of the percentage of compensation that they're getting for, you know, the revenue, and you know, the players are the reason why go to games. You know, I don't have a financial flexibility pendant in the office yet, but I might get one. You know, maybe I can get that championship belt from arbitration a couple of years ago and see if I can put that up. God. That'd be great. But so, like, we go to see, so they understand that they're a huge part of the product, and the owners, from their standpoint, are paying out a significant amount of money on salaries, and they feel like they're the ones that are risking significantly more, and so they want to make sure that they're getting their fair share, or what they feel like is their fair share of the money as well. And then you add into that the fact that there are those more there's so many more platforms to try and raise the tension level. I mean, it is similar to the political discussions that we have in the country now. There's very, because we take everything in our jobs as these sound bites and these quick reactions and all of this to try and get the news out faster, it can leave very little room for nuance. And I think when that happens, you end up with you can end up with more hard feelings, more anger, and more vitriol between the sides. But you know, I think some of this is just the nature of labor negotiations too. And I think the other part of it that has changed is that we now have more coverage of labor negotiations than we ever have before. We also have to cover all of these issues, and so we have a tendency to be more reactionary about what's going on and what is typically, you know, like if this were, I don't know, if this were the you know, the postal workers union, we probably wouldn't be having these same kind of conversations about it, but it's so high profile, we have to feed the monkey man. And so, like, in the end, we end up contributing to, or at least drawing conclusions from the contentious nature of it based on the fact that we see these two sides fighting, and we really have no idea what's going on because we're broadcasters and journalists. We don't have degrees in collective bargaining.
Yes, we're not brain surgeons. We're not brain surgeons.
Well, you know, not everybody can be, but we also are really bad at covering collective bargaining as an industry. Yeah. Like, we are really bad at it. And I learned some of that this summer in talking to some people who are labor attorneys. Like, we suck at it.
They just think we're the stupidest people on the planet, huh? Like, I've had some similar conversations. These people just think we are morons, and they might be right.
Well, yeah, because what they can't, like, to me, what the thing that really shapes all of that is that you've got a scenario in which you've got two combatants and only one side is accessible,
more or less.
So that automatically just changes the chessboard totally compared to, like, another type of business where, you know, both sides actually talk, both sides act, like, that's not what exists in baseball at all. And so it's actually gotten worse. And it was another point I was going to make about it and why this is so different. Like there were, you know, let's go back 30 years ago. Like you would hear about some player ending up on waivers by accident because the GM screwed up.
Yeah.
Right.
Moises Alou, Moises Alou ended up on waivers because they asked for the wrong waivers on him.
Exactly. So stuff like that would happen, and I bring that. That's an obviously an extreme example, but like it is reflective of the level of what we're dealing with here. So you've gone from that to oh shit, put him on waivers as an accident. My bad. Don't claim him. Help me out, guys. And they would, by the way, they'd like don't touch him. They'd make their little agreement and he'd stay where he's supposed to be. But could you imagine that shit happening now? Huh? No. And like the age of like, you know, consultants to come in and basically, yeah, tell us how many baseball people we can lay off and still be fine with. That's what happens in the game today. We are covering people who are beholden to efficiency first, it feels like. And so are those people going to like, these are the folks that are driving this conversation.
I don't think that it's, I mean, now I haven't worked in any other industry other than media, and I've covered only baseball for the last, close to 15 years. So it's tough for me to have any real perspective because it's been a long time. It's been 20 years since I had a retail job even. So like, I'm not entirely sure, but I would assume that this is what's going on in every industry, that this is the battle between, this is the new battle between labor and management, right? Like this is different than 100 years ago. You know, this is like whoever's going to write the jungle for this is probably not going to be focused on food safety so much as, you know, how does everybody get their piece of the pie? Because there should be plenty to go around. And so, yeah, you're right. There are efficiency experts and there are consultants and there are, you know, you're trying to find the most efficient way to, you know, build a contender or to be able to be the most profitable in this. But I don't know that it's any different than any other place. And some of it is just the throes of modern business school. And until somebody finds a more effective way or better way or changes it, it's, you know, we're going to keep going down the same path, but somebody will. I mean, it'll happen. It might take another 10 years, 20 years, whatever. And it may not necessarily change for the better, but it's going to change.
Michael, let me tell you about an economic system called capitalism and how it affects all of the American life. Do you have 45 minutes?
I would be excited to talk about that, Andy, because I do like making money. So
yeah, well, all right. I don't feel like doing this.
Farron, what was your retail job?
My retail job was, so when I quit my job in Indiana, because I just hated it, I went and moved home and I worked in the music department at Borders.
Ooh. Oh, shit.
I was really good too. I had been a classic rock disc jockey. So like, I was like all
that. Oh man.
I used to get secret shopped all the time. And like, I would end up with like the $30 gift cards.
Could you tell? Could you spot a secret shopper?
Never. I never did. But I didn't pay. I just treated everybody well. Wow. Which is what's changed in me.
Very out of character for you.
Yeah, now you don't have time for it.
Yeah. Now you won't buy a lousy beer at the fucking winter meetings. But anyway.
Speaking of giving up and going back home. So I've been thinking, you know, like the Phillies.
Going to get
right?
a little personal?
No. The Phillies are sort of like in the post trying era. The Reds, you know, trading Raisel Iglesias, you know, non-tendering Archie Bradley. They're paring down, you know, looks like they might try and trade Sonny Gray. And these were both teams who engaged in kind of, you know, hard tanking, you know, not maybe not as like extreme as say what the Orioles are doing, but they were, you know, more or less they tore down. And I guess what I'm wondering is from your perspective, like if there's lessons to be learned from the way those things have gone, like what you think the state of tanking is in 2020?
Well, so Buster Olney wrote about this the other day, or at least highlighted, I think, Sam Miller's finale at ESPN on this.
Yeah, Sam had something
on
the Phillies, yeah.
So it focused on the Phillies, but what it ignored was that, and you can throw the Reds into this too, I guess, but the vast majority of the teams that have gone through this have been playoff teams now, right? They, mm-hmm. I mean, you start going through the teams that have torn all the way down. And, you know, the Cubs, the Astros, the White Sox, the, you know, all of these teams that have done it have gotten to the postseason and have been, you know, have been primed or look primed to have long runs. I mean, whether this is the end for the Astros or not, I mean, they've been to the postseason, what, 5 of the last 6 years? Cubs went 5 out of 6 times. Each of them won a World Series championship. You know, they don't have the resources necessarily. Well, I think in the Cubs case, they didn't do a good job of reallocating their resources along the way as they were taking on, you know, more contracts and decided to launch their own television network and stuff like that. But like there are some teams that have done a better job of trying to keep that window open, but all of them, and I think Seattle is going to probably bear fruit here pretty soon, and they've got a chance to be pretty good. Like, they have really good position player prospects and really good starting prospects. I think they're, for the most part, we're going to be hitting like 800 on those, on the ones over the course of the last decade. Now, I don't know what's going to happen with Detroit. I don't know what's going to happen with Baltimore, although I would argue that both of their situations were more traditional in the sense that they had bottomed out. Tigers tried to keep the window open as long as they possibly could. They couldn't do it anymore. There's only one way you can go, and then you have to build up talent from within. Baltimore, remember, there were the year that they lost, what, 117 games or whatever it was. I had two colleagues, former general managers, that picked them to win the division that year. That was supposed to be a good team.
Right.
And it wasn't. And so, like, they had bottomed out. So, like, those aren't teams that, like the White Sox or the Mariners that were in the middle and had good assets and sunk them. I mean, I think what you have to look at is the decision-making from the organization and what they did. And, like, with in the case of the Phillies, they just never really developed enough talent. I mean, they got really high-risk, high-reward prospects back from the Rangers, and none of them panned out. None of them panned out. I mean, who was the best player that came back in that deal? Jared Eichhoff?
Yeah, probably.
You know, like, who was, like, the fifth piece, right? Yeah. Like, so, like, that ended up not working. And that was, again, you know, that was a previous administration, and they were very, like, tools-oriented. But I understood why they made the Hamels deal. Those guys made sense for them. In the Reds' case, they were, you know, they had kind of gotten to the point where they were going to need to trade guys, and they traded Cueto, and they didn't get a ton back for him because of when they did it. And so, like, you're going through a rebuild, and you have to identify the right talent in the organization. You have to draft well at the top of the draft. You have to make smart trades. You have to win those margins. You need to get the guy who, you know, looks like he might be in, or guy, but one of your scouts thinks an adjustment, or PD guys thinks he can make an adjustment to bring him to a regular. You need to hit on all those things. And I think if you don't get there, then you need to have a significant internal evaluation about why you made the choices you did and where you missed, and how you have to fix that. And it's probably going to be somebody else who's going to be the general manager that fixes it. I don't love the idea of punting a season. I think that there are times that you have to do it, like I said, with Baltimore and Detroit, where you're just kind of, you're forced down that road, you know. But I think that just to use those two teams as a referendum against what things have gone is probably disingenuous as well, because it ignores the teams that have had success doing it. I also think that they did it at a time when there was probably less benefit from it, because there were more teams that were going through it. So if more teams are doing it, then there's probably fewer opportunities for that. And, you know, in the case of like Seattle and the White Sox, they were actually starting from a little bit better talent base, trading some really talented players in order to get, you know, some of this group of can't miss guys that would be stars going forward.
You know, it's interesting kind of contrasting like the teams who did the hard tanks with clubs like the A's, the Brewers, and like even the D-backs, right? Who like have threaded the needle from through contention cycles. And like, I'm curious actually, you know, with the D-backs, right? Like, I tease you a lot because, you know, you work for them or whatever it is you do.
Because I wear, like, Sedona red colored glasses.
Because you, yeah, because like you're the mascot half the time or something. But like, the organization does a lot of things right. They play a good brand of baseball. They clearly like have an identity that makes a lot of sense. And they're also, just because of like the fact that they play in the West with the Dodgers, like in a very, very difficult position. And so I'm just kind of wondering, like, for teams in that spot who like want to contend but, you know, are either unable or unwilling to spend the financial resources, like, how do you How do you get past the super teams, I guess?
Well, they haven't yet, so I don't know that I have a good answer for that. You know, and now the Padres are pretty good, and the right. Giants are about ready to be fully operational, which is kind of scary. So,
yeah,
I think it's just trying. I mean, I don't think that there's anything that really is reinventing the wheel. I think what they have tried to do is take advantage of where there is an inefficiency in the marketplace, which has been that there have been these kind of league average players that have been available that are upgrades over maybe what they had, who aren't going to be too expensive compared to what they've done, you know, over the course of their of what other guys would be who might be a little bit better, or what you would expect them to be over the course of their career, and try and get the most that they can out of like the Cole Calhouns, or trading for Eduardo Escobar and getting him on a reasonable contract then beyond that, and you know, finding those players who are pretty good and just pretty good players. Like, having a lot of pretty good players is good. You need a star to build around. They had that with Paul Goldschmidt. I think they still have it with Ketel Marte, even though the power numbers weren't there in the shortened season. So you need some of that, and you need that player to be relatively inexpensive. And then you have to draft and develop, and you have to make smart trades. So you have to know when you have to do as good a job or a better job of scouting your system as you do others, I think, because I think you have to have an understanding of who the guys are that are can't miss, that can't be touched, because you need those players in their control years. And then you have to find the ones that are going to be attractive to the industry that you really don't believe in, so that you can add major leaguers to your roster to be able to help out. And hopefully ones that are inexpensive. I think it's why I don't think this guy's going to be a pretty good player. I think he's got a real chance to be, but the Jazz Chisholm for Zach Gallen trade is a really fascinating one. I mean, that's like a straight up baseball trade. Financial transactions overall, but like this was like two rookies traded for one another, and like they both have a chance to be pretty good. They filled a need for each spot. They knew they needed Gallen. I think Gallen is, I mean, you guys have seen Gallen. Gallen's really good.
He's really good.
Really good, and he's gonna explode. That was a great identification to figure out that he was good and that he was available. So I think making those kind of deals makes sense. And then you can't be afraid to have to rip the Band-Aid off. You have to do a little bit of the Tampa, maybe not to the same degree that they do with the Rays, but like when Paul Goldschmidt has a year left and he's 32 years old, you probably have to disappoint your fan base and trade him, so that you can get players back that can help. And they got, you know, solid players in Carson Kelly and Luke Weaver, who aren't stars, but are solid. And again, trying to build out that base and then, you know, continue to be as competitive as possible. And hopefully you're adding at the deadline, or if you're out of the race, you need to be aggressive in trading players away to be able to replenish that, to be able to have that next group, that next wave of players ready. So I think it's not really all that untraditional in its manner. Maybe it's just different because it looks like the way teams operated for, you know, throughout the 60s, or good teams, you know, teams that were competitive largely throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, it's the context that makes it look different, right? For sure. And I, you know, I kind of root for him just for the sense of you want teams to do that. You want them to try. You want them to, like, put resources into acquiring good ball players. And have they been as talented as the Dodgers? Clearly not. But is it possible to assemble a well-crafted team that, if you get them in the playoff series against the Dodgers, like, has a shot? Sure. In this sport, absolutely. So I think it's been interesting. It's been fun to watch the way they operate. And I'm glad you brought up Gallen, because to me, like, just this season, for the shortened season, like, you know, it got to the point where, like, I didn't want to miss a start.
Yeah.
I just liked the way he went out there and got after it. And it was kind of intriguing too, because he plays in Arizona. He's an easy guy to overlook.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the Marlins have made this habit of trading away some really good pitchers. And at the end of the day, he might end up being the best one. I mean, I was super impressed by him. I know you see him all the time, but, like, yeah, it was like, it was kind of appointment viewing. If he was on the bump, like, I would try to see some of that game.
Yeah, I mean, Marlins still have some pretty good pitching there too, and they traded it. They did, you know, deal him away. Yeah, he's you know, he has the starter kit for what you expect to be a guy like he's it's not a fair comparison because their stuff is different, but he's kind of that Aaron Nola type, you know, where it's like no one thing really blows you away, but then you watch everything together and you're like, oh yeah, this, and then add in the competitiveness and the really, really thick, you know, Philadelphia area accent. And like, it's just like he's very South Jersey in the way he talks, and there's something in the water that it really allows him to tap into to that. And I think that that's, you know, I mean, okay, so like he's a star level player potentially, right? Marte's a star level player. But the other part of this comes into the on-field stuff, which is execution. And they were really bad at doing this year, at doing the things that they generally have done really well, the things that you guys appreciate in watching them. They have been a very good base running team. They have been an excellent defensive team. They have not beaten themselves, because when you're David, you can't miss with that first rock that you fire at Goliath. Yes. You got to hit, and you've got to be able to have, you just have to be able to win those margins. And that's where they had been really successful and need to get back to if they're going to be competitive again in 2021.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Well, I remember when I was covering the Royals, I used to Dayton Moore and I would sometimes talk about this idea of like, if fans are invested in the way a team plays baseball, like the style. And, you know, he would just kind of ask like open-ended, like, do you think it matters that we play the way we play? And my answer would always be, I think fans like winning. I think they want to see the team win. They don't necessarily care in what way they do it. But I think I might have been wrong about that. I think, or is that just too much of a negative reaction to watching all the pitching changes and, you know, platooning and all that sort of stuff in the postseason? Like, do you have a take on that? Do you think there is a certain aesthetic style that teams should shoot for, or do you think the goal should just be to try and win?
No, I think that, I mean, I think if you are employed by a team, your goal is to win, because that's what's going to keep your job, or at least it should be. You know, that's the only thing that matters is that you win. So I don't think that it's matters stylistically. I kind of disagree on the aesthetics. I mean, I think we tend to romanticize the baseball that we grew up with, and then we do the same thing that John Smoltz does, right? We romanticize the era that we remember best and then try and apply it to the current era, right? Losing sight of what was both the good and bad, or reasons why things were successful or weren't. So I grew up in the 80s. So like, I love like the Eric Davis, you know, Daryl Strawberry, like crazy, like awesome athletic, like 30-30 guys like playing all over the field and slapping the ball around and hitting run and watching the Cardinals steal bases and all that stuff. It doesn't mean it was good baseball. It's just the baseball that I remember. And I think if you go back and watch a game from 1982, like at the beginning of the shutdown, they ran the famous the Phillies Cubs 23-22 game. Like, watch that game. Go back and watch that game. Do yourself a favor and watch it. See how far you can get into it before you're like, I'm out. Like, this is terrible. This is awful. Why has everybody got a closed stance? You know, like why is everybody slapping the ball on the ground? You know, why is Randy Lurch throwing 72-mile-an-hour fastballs?
Yeah. That's the one that stands out the most. Whenever I see games from that era, you see these pitchers out there who aren't even in particularly great shape, not throwing particularly hard. You know, they're up to their 140th pitch, and it's the same stuff. Like, you know, like missing all over the place. Like, it's just not as skilled. And, like, I hate saying that, like, I'm bagging on them, because I'm not.
No!
Like, when the context of their time, they were freaking the best in the world.
Go watch Seaver's no-hitter.
It's different.
It's the same thing. Mm. Like, go watch Seaver's no-hitter, and you look at it now in the context of what you see, and go, man, what, like, is it really that dominant of stuff? But like, you're watching the hitters react and you're going, I guess it is, you know, like, you're right. It's entirely in context.
100%.
I mean, I think if I could change one thing, it would be the pacing issue. I really think that the style of play, the one that you find so aesthetically displeasing, Andrew, with the strikeouts and the
dingers. It could
dingers,
just be, by the way, that I just don't like baseball.
Well, that's always a possibility.
That could just be the possibility.
But you also hate people, so you're in the right line of work.
I never said I liked anything.
Loves words,
anyway,
though.
Sorry, go.
That's true. Is there a physical aspect to that, too, though? Because I've read that, right? That some of the time between pitches is literally people getting physically ready to throw another baseball 100 miles an hour. And then to get yourself physically ready to do that again over and over and over again is going to require more time in between. I mean, doesn't that make sense?
I've read that too. And yeah, I think it does. But have we seen a drop in velocity in the minor leagues where they've had a pitch clock for how long? I mean, it doesn't seem like we have, and the games have gotten shorter. So maybe except for the PCL in 2019, because I don't know if you know this, ball was really flying that year.
But for the most part,
at like AA, A-ball, you know, where the pitch clock is gone, they've been the games got shorter and guys still threw hard. So I think yes, on the surface, that would be my buy-in on it. Was like, yeah, it probably does. But I don't necessarily know. If you want a game that's more active, where more balls are put in play, do you want guys that, you know, that throw 94-95 instead of 97-98? Maybe. You know, maybe that's a, you know, not a bad thing necessarily. Maybe it promotes pitcher health too, to not necessarily have that ramped up. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it makes them more susceptible to injury because they're more fatigued with every pitch that they throw. But I don't know the answer to it at all. But I would think that, I mean, I would just like to see it all happen faster.
Isn't the issue less velocity than just movement? Like I wonder, you know, wouldn't, I mean, they should just ban the sticky stuff, or at the very least have a standard issue sticky stuff that
you should only be allowed to throw 3 off-speed or breaking pitches per at bat, and then everything will be fine.
Oh no! You can't do that to Rich Hill. you're taking bread off Rich Hill's table.
He just 3 straight curveballs and it's game over.
Well, that to me, like, because people talk about like banning the shift, like I don't like that. I don't like the idea of regulating the shift. I want fewer rules. Like I think the every time you add a rule, it becomes, there's unintended consequences. But it seems like getting rid of sticky stuff, or at least regulating it, would be a way to make it so that every pitcher who comes into the game isn't the best pitcher you've ever seen.
I do think that there's something about like the anticipation that's, so as a broadcaster, like I love those anticipatory moments. You're in the big spot late in the game, the big hitter gets into the 3-1 count, and everybody knows the fastball is coming, right? And you want to know what's happened. And it's taken, maybe because that predictability has happened. I'm just, because I've not heard this before, I'm just kind of thinking through this. Because that predictability has happened, we take less out of those anticipatory moments because we're just anticipating, like, okay, well, it's 3-1. He's going to get a breaking ball here, right? Like, it's going to be a strike, and then it's going to be 3-2, and then he's going to swing a slider in the dirt, and then it's going to be over. So it takes that. It takes us out of that moment and that edge that we have as a fan, where we want to be on the edge of our seat for what we anticipate is the big moment.
It's a great way to put it too. It's about the wait.
Yeah.
Like I think we forget that part of the equation so much. We focus on action, 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 action. Yet this is a sport that is predicated on appreciating and anticipating, and kind of that big moment, the lead up is just as good. right? So it's yeah, and I guess like some of that the takeaway from that is reduced when there's just so many instances where you can predict and do it accurately, and yeah. that kind of and so that's why when this longtime executive said that, like I kind of stopped for a second. It's like, damn, that's a great way to put it.
But I wonder if we could do a better job as broadcasters of selling those anticipatory moments. I mean, you were fortunate, Mark, in that you get to grow up listening to Bill King, who I think is one of the best ever at making you feel like every moment you were on the edge of your seat. In fact, I think there was something that he talked about once that he said, you know, if you're listening to the game and I can get you and just make that little twist, then I know I have you, right? And he was so good at that. And I think we spend so much time presenting facts, information, stories, that at times we lose sight of building that anticipation and excitement for the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's not even the moment. Like, you want the payoff as a fan, right? Like, you want your guy to hit the 3-run homer in that spot. But the, you know, on the 3-1 pitch when he fouls it back, that's a big moment, and it's like, oh gosh, you know, and then you get frustrated again. Like, you have to be able to play the excitement levels off of all of that, and I don't know that we necessarily do a good job of that as a whole as announcers in playing up those moments.
Interesting. I love that you got a Bill King reference in here. That makes my
Bill
day
King
right
is like Bill King is the
man.
He is the man. He's maybe the greatest basketball announcer of all time. I think he's one of the most underrated baseball announcers of all time. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Bill King, if you've never listened to Bill King do a baseball game, like, go find him, because you can find him on the internet, man. They are so good. Great.
Go listen to the Raider clips.
Yeah.
Every Raider moment of the 70s
Holy roller.
Is Bill King just being amazing at his job. And by the way, Kenny Korak, mm-hmm. who he worked with and like took over, like, Ken's great at that too, actually.
Yeah.
I think like it's been fun. Like, Bay Area people are lucky, man. Like, there's a lot of great announcing both sides of the Bay.
Pat Hughes in Chicago. If you get to those big moments, and Pat is very, very regimented in the way he speaks and the way he sets situations up. But in those big moments, he knows how to draw you into him, and that you grew up listening to Bill King.
I don't watch much baseball, so I don't know kind of what you guys are talking about.
Why do you hate baseball so much? I always wonder this.
I don't hate baseball.
All these jokes about it all the time. It's like, I don't watch much baseball. I don't do that. Like you work for The Athletic. You don't have a deadline. Like, why aren't you just watching baseball? Seriously, like, it drives me fucking nuts, Andy. Like, I will sit in the press box and be like, I haven't watched a game in 6 months. Screw you. Like, this is
Holy Toledo.
First of all, Michael, I spent 9 years on the beat. Okay. I spent 9 years. You don't know what that's like.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've only been dressing up like, you know, the D-backs dinosaur for like four or five.
Okay? Your life is so hard, Andy.
No, I like baseball. I just joke about it. You know, it's because here's the thing. I don't work for baseball. And maybe you and I maybe slightly differ about this, and that's fine. Like, I don't like look down on people who feel this way, but like, I don't think that as a journalist my job necessarily is to like help the sport promote itself better or like, you know, be more exciting or anything like that. Like, I don't work for the sport. Like, I'm just interested in like the people involved and telling stories about that. And so this is my like defense mechanism, you know, that I put up because I just, you know, don't really like, I don't know, I don't always think that we should spend a lot of time worrying about like what's good for baseball. Like, I think about what's good for my readers, I guess.
Well, and I think that's actually
and
really
sometimes
healthy.
Those things intertwine.
Yeah.
So
I think that's really healthy because I think you need a balance of both things. Yeah. I spend a lot of time, listen, I'm a broadcaster on for a team. You know, I work for a team and a team broadcaster, and I also work for a rights holder. You know, and a lot of what I want people to listen to baseball on the radio because I want them to have that experience. I want them to enjoy baseball. That it's a different role. It's why I'm not a journalist. I'm a broadcaster. And there's a significant difference. There are times where I'm a reporter, where I'm delivering to you the facts of what's happening in a situation, but I'm not someone who is allowed to, by nature of their job, to be dispassionate about the subject or to take that away. I don't think that's possible. So let me throw this one at you, because I thought about this the other day, and I'm starting to ask people about it. we talked about how players are probably better than they were. The game looks different than it did in the 70s and the 80s and all of this, right? The same can certainly be said for executives, right? So mm-hmm. I'm curious, if you were to take, and don't name names, you know, or you don't have to name names, but whoever you think is the worst general manager in baseball, in what year would you have to go back to for them to be the best general manager in baseball?
2005. I'd say about 2005.
No, you'd have to go farther.
I think you might have to go a little bit further than that.
You think so?
Yeah, because Theo was already around in 2005, changing things. Billy Beane was around in 2005. I don't think that the guys who are at the bottom of the group, whoever you would rank at the bottom now, would be there. I think you have to go back to like 1995.
Also, they have to be the best of the bunch. Not
you have
like
to go back
good.
To 1981. You have to go to 1981 when Sandy Alderson took over the A's, and that's at best, because I'm sure there was someone in 1980 who was better than the guy I have at 30 right now. So I you'd have to go back a really long way.
What about number 29? How far back do you have to go for number 29? Well, I know, but you know what I mean? Like it's, yeah. I think it's kind of a fun exercise to speak to, like, to what Mark was talking about, how there's competency, like there's general competency. You can go back
and take
most every executive and go back through baseball history, and there would be a point where they would be the best or among the best,
right?
Even the ones who you would look at and are at the bottom of however you would evaluate them now.
The way to frame it is you could take the guy who's theoretically like the fifth worst at the job now, and if you go back 20 years, that guy might be top five, yeah. Whoever
well,
that
is. Well, I think, you know, okay, that's a great example of this is Andy McPhail. Like, and not to knock, I mean, listen, Andy's had a great career and tremendous baseball family and a huge part of it, but like the Phillies are in disarray right now with him as the president. But think back to 1986 and 1987 when he was running the Twins, and he was the best executive in baseball, right? Like that's right. the same guy, right? Like he went through the transitions with, you know, some rough years with the Cubs, then some pretty good ones when he was running it. And then like there's a whole lot of just in that, in his career arc, in watching how the people have changed around him as he's, you know, he's evolved, but how, you know, how he has kind of fit into it. I don't think you would put him in the top five executives right now. And you might put him in the bottom five. And I hope I'm not offending Andy to say that. I probably am. But like that guy's accomplished more in baseball than I ever will. But it's just the way that the game has evolved overall.
Hey, I thought you were going to paint your office. Farron referenced this earlier, Andy. Like we had a pretty testy text exchange about some dorky ass baseball thing. But it began with Farron going, hey, your office wall's nice, or your wall, your collar's nice. Like, what is that? And then I went down to the basement, like, unearthed all the cans, like found like the actual pin collar and send it. And now I look at his office right now on this call. That is not the collar that is on my wall. So what the hell is going on here?
It wasn't for my office. It was for my wife's. My wife wanted it, I think, for our bedroom or something else. And she decided to go with a very light pink in her office. So she's taken over. So she is an executive, like a marketing and communications director who is working at home, who unfortunately is just on the other side of this closet that's to my right. And so she has today put up with like 6.5 hours of my loud ass just making noise while she's trying to like save the world and sustainability.
Yeah.
And like right before we recorded this, she was like, you were really loud today. I was like, it's going to get worse.
it's just you shouting, Jim, would you rather have George Springer for 8 years or JT Realmuto for six? Just over and over.
By the way, hot chocolate came from our producer, Hunter, walking into the studio with hot chocolate at 10 a.m. one day, just going, hot chocolate. He was all fired up about it.
I love it. Full circle, baby.
That way, that's my doppelganger, right?
Yes. Yeah, you know Hunter.
Hunter's my doppelganger? Yeah. DC Andy, they call him. If you've listened to this much Mike Farron, you clearly are a masochist. Yes. And if you've listened to this much and you are not a subscriber to The Athletic, go to theathletic.com/beyondthescrum and join. It's a good site. You'll like it.
I already joined.
Good. Hey, thanks everyone for listening. Have a good one.